You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2001, Melanie Thernstrom's editor at The New York Times gave her an assignment to write about the chronic pain that plagued her and so many others. She dove in as a tenacious reporter as well as a suffering patient to learn all she could about the subject, what causes it, what cures it, and why some people can never seem to be rid of it. She visited our show in November to discuss the pain chronicles, cures, myths, mysteries, prayers, diaries, brain scans, healing, and the science of suffering, the book that grew out of her reporting. A lot of listeners responded to that segment, and we thought that we would play it for you again on this long holiday weekend. Our conversation started as soon as I introduced her.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan, longtime admirer of this show, and former New Yorker, still a New Yorker at heart.
I'm going to get right to business. Thank you so much for the compliment. Does physical pain serve a purpose? I would assume it does.
Oh, very much so. Physical pain is one of our most, in some ways, the most fundamental physical function. It is the way that nature protects our body from harm. And the vital protective aspect of pain is very dramatically illustrated by an interesting disease, a genetic disease called congenital analgesia, where people lack the ability to feel pain. And when you first hear about that, you think, wow, that doesn't really sound like a disease. Like, these people must be living in the Garden of Eden. And in fact, they always usually die by their early 20s because they destroy their bodies. They walk backwards on their knees. They scratch their corneas. Like, you see how quickly the body wears out.
Well, it seems to me that if once the body tells you that there's a pain and you're alerted, the problem is that it keeps on causing the pain. You already know you got a problem.
Right. Well, so there are two – this is one of something I was very surprised to discover in my research. As a lay person, we think there's one kind of pain, which is protective pain. Pain is the signal that there is tissue damage and that you need to take care of your body. And that pain goes away when the injury heals.
That's acute pain.
That is acute pain. But there is another kind of pain that is qualitatively different, and that is chronic pain. And chronic pain, the analogy that I think works the best for it is that acute pain is like an alarm signaling that there's a fire, and chronic pain is like a broken alarm where it's sounding on, and yet there is no fire. There's no disease. There's no injury. The injury may have healed years before, or there may never have been one.
But the nerves are damaged, or is something else going on?
Yes, it's a pathology of the nervous system. So it's a problem that lies in the brain or in the spinal cord. And many of the worst kinds of chronic pain, say spinal cord injury, where the body is completely numb. You think, how can you have any pain when your body is numb? They have terrible pain because their brain generates terrible pain.
The same reason some people who have been amputated, had a foot amputated or something, still feel a pain on their foot.
Yes. Phantom limb pain is one of the sort of best examples that you can easily understand that that pain is actually in the brain because you're feeling it in a hand, say, that's been amputated. You can feel the pressure of a wedding ring on that hand. You can feel an itch you had before the hand was gone. So it's a very fascinating thing.
Is it possible to know how many Americans suffer from chronic pain?
You know, the estimates range a great deal, and I give the landscape of them in the book with footnotes so people can look at them. Many of them are between 5 and 10% of the population.
But 5 and 10% is a big variance.
Right. And that's also just a very, you know, big number. It seems to depend exactly on how the question is asked. And so if it's everyone who's suffering from pain in the past 3 months, you get an enormous percentage. You know, many, many, many older people. Yes. In a way, a more interesting question is what percentage of those people will the pain remain chronic, intractable? Will it get worse? Will it become what scientists now call pain the disease, where it makes these pathological changes in the brain and spinal cord?
It actually makes changes in the brain.
Yes, this was one of the most surprising things I found in my research, that I thought the brain and spinal cord was hardwired like a computer. But in fact, it turns out it's softwired. And there's this quality called neuroplasticity, which is that the nerve pathways change. And most of the time, that's a positive thing. That's how you learn. But in the case of pain, it's a very negative thing, because it turns out that the longer you have pain, the more the system revs up and becomes more efficient at generating pain. And the analogy that is often used is like a river carving its way through a canyon. Over time, it cuts deeper and deeper, and the river flows more quickly. So the longer you have pain, a deeper level of neurons are activated in the spinal cord.
So even though the thing that caused the pain originally may be gone,
and
you're still having the pain.
You're still having the pain. And this is something that all pain specialists understand, but many primary care physicians and other kinds of doctors don't. And so people will often, you know, go to the doctor and say, I have terrible back pain and I'm not sleeping and my life is falling apart. And the doctor will say, you know, look at them. Maybe they'll even do an MRI. I don't know. Your back looks fine. And then they'll refer them for counseling and they will pathologize them. And they don't understand that the problem is not in something they can see in their back, it's in the nervous system.
Athletes have complained about this over the years. They've been told that they were shirking when they had terrible pain because the MRI didn't reveal anything. And often, I mean, in the case of an athlete, it usually means I'm feeling pain, because they tend to have high thresholds.
Yes.
Well, and I've always wondered about that. What is a high threshold for pain as opposed to a low threshold? Is there a real genetic difference?
It's a very interesting thing. There is definitely some genetic difference in pain perception. Women are more sensitive to pain than men, for example. As a layperson, before I did my research, I assumed just the opposite. I thought, women, the pain of childbirth, and I thought that women had higher pain thresholds, but that just turns out not to be true. It's also not true in male and female rats. It may be an adaptive thing for men as warriors, as male rats or fighters, coping with the pain of wounds. But for whatever reason, and there are other variations, very interesting research showing that different ethnic groups have different pain thresholds.
Well, for the warrior, there is the initial pain, and then endorphins start rushing through the system and make it easier, at least for a short time, for the person to do what is necessary to escape.
But, yes.
So is it a matter of how efficient our endorphin system is as to how we handle pain?
Yes. Everyone's brain has a pain modulatory system that can turn on pain and turn off pain. It literally sends something called on or off signals into the spinal cord that magnify the incoming pain information or shut it down. And so if you are in a flight or fight, survival stress syndrome, your brain has other priorities, and it conveniently arrests all of the pain information, all the pain signals in the spinal cord, and you feel no pain. For example, I wrote about Bethany Hamilton, a young surfer who had her arm bitten off by a shark, and she said, very aptly, she said, I didn't feel any pain, which is good, because I don't know how things would have gone for me if I had felt pain. And that's just what Mother Nature was thinking.
But then later the pain definitely becomes oppressive.
The pain, yes.
Because we no longer need to the flight thing to happen anymore. So now our body's telling us, a shark just bit off your arm.
Exactly. So this phenomena, the technical name for it is stress-induced descending analgesia. This is always temporary because for primitive man, it was a survival advantage to be able to turn off the pain temporarily. It would be a survival disadvantage to turn it off long-term because you wouldn't be forced to tend to the pain of your wounds.
My guest is Melanie Thernstrom, who is a contributing writer to The New York Times, author of a number of books, the most recent, The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. How did your chronic pain first start?
Well, it started in a very mysterious way. Almost 14 years ago, I went swimming across a pond with a boyfriend, and nothing happened. But that night, I was kept awake by a strange burning sensation in my neck and shoulder. And it simply never got better, and it got worse over the months. And I tried wishing it away, ignoring it. I tried meditation, visualization. I half-heartedly sought medical attention, and it continued to deteriorate. And after a few years, I finally got an MRI and was diagnosed with a type of arthritis. But I really didn't start doing effective pain treatment until I got the assignment from the Times Magazine.
But the arthritis had to have already been in the works.
Oh, yes.
It's not the swimming
event
that brought this on. But that's when you first became aware of it. And
right.
I'm assuming you, like so many other people, thought, okay, I must have pulled a muscle
yes.
or something, and it'll go away.
Yes, the swimming was a red herring. But the swimming confused me because I thought that pain always came from an injury. And so I was very stuck on the fact that I didn't have an injury. And I also believed that pain always got better over time if you didn't have an injury. And even if you did, the injury would heal over time. And so I felt that if I ignored it, then it would go away on its own. And I didn't have the model of pain as a disease in which the longer you neglect it, the worse it gets and the harder it is to reverse. And I wish I had known that because I feel that I missed the critical window of time.
But in doing the research for this book, did you were you at all able to alleviate some of the psychic pain that you experienced? Because I'm sure you thought for a while this was something that you were experiencing, but it was kind of a unique thing for you.
Oh, very much. I mean, having a biological understanding of my pain sort of at a deep psychic level, which I didn't have except by doing the research for the magazine article and eventually the book, it was very helpful for me, very therapeutic, because before I had that understanding, I saw it subliminally as kind of a personal failure, a defect, or a failure to be happy, or maybe I didn't want to be happy, or maybe I was cursed, maybe I was unlucky. I had different unhappy ways of understanding it that were all very vague and unhelpful.
My guest is Melanie Thernstrom, whose latest book is The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview I did in November with Melanie Thernstrom. She was here to discuss her book, The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. One of the things that we talked about was that pain has been seen historically as a force for spiritual transformation. And I asked Melanie Thernstrom, is that something that's only true in Western cultures, or is it something that occurs to people all over the world?
This is one of the most interesting aspects of pain, is its enormous flexibility of meaning. And in almost all religions, physical pain has in the past, and in some religions still is, plays an enormous role in the religion. And pilgrims in many traditions have testified to the transformative effects of physical pain.
So how does that affect the way we have thought about pain over the years when we were trying to treat it in a medical way?
Well, I think it's a very complicated thing because
because we bring preconceptions to this whole matter, don't we?
Yes, and I would say I think in a medical context, believing that imbuing your pain with religious meanings can be helpful or it can be extremely harmful because it can hold you back from getting treatment. It can be laden with the sense that you deserve to suffer, that God is suffering, causing you suffering. And I write about a fascinating study that tries to look at whether being religious actually helps or harms your pain.
Well, some people believe that prayer helps some people overcome pain. And then, of course, there's Christian Science, which believes that you don't have to go to a doctor, you shouldn't go to a doctor. The whole thing can be resolved through a relationship with God.
Indeed. On my father's side of the family, my father was brought up Christian Scientist, and my grandparents were Christian Scientists.
Did that make you more reluctant to go seek medical treatment initially? Because you also have written about science over the years.
Right. I think in some way it did, actually. I think there was some way I saw it as a problem that I preferred to solve in some other way, and I certainly tried a lot of other approaches. And this study that I was talking about found about the effects of being religious on pain, of going to church and praying and reading the Bible. It was very interesting because it found that what it called positive religiosity, people who feel that their illness drew them closer to God, do better, that being religious is very helpful. But people who experience what they call negative religiosity, that their pain makes them question God's existence or feel that God has abandoned them or is punishing them, they do much worse than people who aren't religious. So being religious can help you or it can harm you.
And how is that explained? Placebo effect?
No, I think, pain draws on the meaning-making parts of the brain. Pain is a meaningful experience by definition. And if you believe that you are being punished, this is going to give you more pain.
Now, you mentioned earlier that women tend to suffer pain more than men. Certain racial groups and ethnic groups have different experiences with pain. Did doctors understand that? If I go to a doctor, would a doctor immediately start going through some kind of checklist?
No, it's not really at the moment. It's more research looking at it in the genetic level, brain imaging studies. It doesn't at this point really have clinical applications, except that the doctor would try to treat your pain. It seems to explain, for example, African Americans disproportionately suffer from chronic pain. Obese people disproportionately suffer from chronic pain and various other groups. And some of the research on how, for example, the African Americans modulate pain, appears that their body actually modulates pain more poorly. And it was particularly striking because in earlier ages, there was the racist mythology that slaves did not suffer pain. And there was a great deal of writing in Victorian and earlier times about how slaves and savages were practically insensate to pain. There's a medical journal I quote from several centuries ago saying that slave women can withstand cutting in practicing surgeries as well as rabbits or dogs.
How convenient for the slave owner to think
indeed,
that.
Indeed. Convenient for the surgeon.
Well, isn't pain subjective? How can someone like a doctor really measure someone else's pain?
Well, that is an excellent question. And the truth is, in the clinic right now, they can't. And so that's why so many people with pain have the experience of not being believed and not getting the help that they need before it's too late. Or until it's at least, quite far along. But in the laboratory, we can see pain. We can see brain imaging studies of the brain generating pain. And there's a lot of fascinating research coming out right now discovering pain-related genes that make people vulnerable to developing chronic pain.
I'd also imagine that an articulate person would be better able to explain to a doctor just what's going on in the body. I don't know if that ultimately leads to better medical treatment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, educated people, affluent as well as affluent people get, you know, much better pain treatment. There are some very depressing studies about how poor people are extremely likely to be undertreated for pain. And minorities, even when they're not poor, are even more unlikely to be well treated for pain and are much less likely to be prescribed opiates. There's a bias, a prejudice that says that doctors feel that minorities are more likely to sell their opiates or misuse them.
Are opiates the best way to treat really serious pain?
No. I mean, very frequently, unfortunately, they're not. They can be a useful tool. They're very complicated drugs, so they can be helpful, they can be harmful, and they're usually one of a range of treatments, and it really depends on the type of treatment. But when they're appropriate, you know, they're often work with other drugs, with antidepressants, which actually work on pain, not just depression, with nerve stabilizing drugs, with anti-inflammatories, with physical therapy. So there really needs to be a package.
A listener asks about acupuncture. Other people go to chiropractors when they have pain. Do they tend to work?
It really depends. There's a lot of mixed data on the efficacy of both of those treatments. I would say most of the pain specialists that I interview believe that acupuncture is placebo. That is, there's a lot of studies that show it doesn't seem to matter the pattern of needles that you do, that the most important factor in the success of acupuncture is belief on the part of the patient and belief on the part of the practitioner.
Well, if it works, then isn't that good?
That is an excellent point, and that is exactly how I feel. So when a doctor says, well, you know, my patients all claim they benefit from acupuncture, but we know from studies it's placebo, I feel like placebo is the gold standard of pain treatment. Placebo literally means your pain modulatory system being activated and taking care of your pain.
I wonder if those doctors would have the same reaction if they knew that giving somebody a sugar pill would ease up the pain. They'd probably say, well, that's a good thing because we're not putting opiates in the body.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what people don't understand is that pain is a perception, and so it's a conscious experience. And so if you are not perceiving pain for whatever reason, because placebo, your brain has kicked in its own endorphins, because you're distracted, because have been bitten by a shark and your brain is in survival mode, you are not feeling pain. I often observed patients in doctor's appointments. I researched the book by observing hundreds of patient appointments and following a large group of patients, about 100 for 8 years, and seeing who got better and who got worse. I often observed patients saying they didn't want pain treatment because they were afraid the medicine would mask the pain. And so there you have the profound misunderstanding that you cannot mask pain, that pain is a perception, and if you take a medicine that alleviates the pain, you do not have pain, period.
My guest is Melanie Thernstrom. Her book, The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In looking back over the history of people talking about pain, what was the general approach in the past, I don't know, four millennia back? Do we know?
Yes. I write quite a bit about the ancient Mesopotamian tablets and how striking it is how physical pain preoccupies all of those ancient religions. And in the Babylonian creation myth, toothache is a part of it. And that tells us what an important part of their experience of life on Earth toothache was. Before the 18th, 19th century, there was pain was always seen as a spiritual signifier. It in ancient times, it came from the realm of demon and deities, and then in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it came from God. And right around the mid-19th century discovery of anesthesia, people switched to another paradigm, which is just pain as biological, a biological phenomenon.
But there's also the psychological phenomenon, the psychosomatic theory. And you tell some stories here, like the one about Lee Burke, who had pain following a brain tumor operation.
Indeed. Well, that 19th century paradigm of pain as a purely biological phenomena of, signaling tissue damage, that the modern understanding of pain, even though many doctors don't yet know it, is actually no, pain is a perception in the brain. And I tell the story of many patients, including Lee Burke, who failed to get pain treatment for years and years because their pain was pathologized. And
And you blame the person who has the pain instead of trying to treat the person who has the pain.
Anyone who has persistent pain over many years will become depressed. They will be not sleeping. Their life will fall apart. And then what will be visible to the doctor is those symptoms rather than the pain. And so I saw Lee Burke was finally correctly diagnosed with having nerves cut from her brain tumor operation and given nerve stabilizing medicines and appropriate treatments, and her pain changed and her life went back.
But are we seeing a lot of success stories today, or is it still a mixed bag?
It certainly is a mixed bag. Many of the patients, most of the patients I followed made progress and got better and were able to restore their lives. And some got cured, and some got worse. So I saw the whole spectrum. Chronic pain often is a chronic disease. And so people often, do have some level of pain. And I guess as I felt with myself, I made great progress with it, and I was able to get on with my life and get back to my life and, go on. And I now have 1-year-old twins, and my pain is not the center of my life, but I do have pain still.
And you still have the rheumatism, I'm assuming.
I still have.
Was it rheumatoid arthritis?
No. It's several types of osteoarthritis. So I still have the underlying conditions, of course, and I still have some pain from them, but it's at a very manageable level. If pain is the first thing in your consciousness, it drives you to crazy. If pain is the seventh thing on your mind in the background, like the awareness that it's raining out, it's fine.
Just one more question. If somebody is experiencing terrible pain, is a pain clinic the best place to go?
It really is. I mean, they really need to see a pain specialist, possibly a physiatrist or rehabilitation specialist or rheumatologist or neurologist. I mean, there are other specialties that treat pain. But if they're not getting good pain treatment, finding a board-certified pain specialist is really a good move.
I had sciatica on and off for years, and then I went to physical therapy, and I have not had any pain there since. I thought it was going to be with me for the rest of my life.
That is wonderful. And physical therapy is certainly the single treatment that's helped me the most, and that I saw patients who were really able. It's one of the few treatments that can be a cure because it involves actually changing the body, and so changing the problems, whereas medication is rarely a cure.
Melanie Thernstrom is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of a number of books, The Dead Girl and Halfway Heaven, Diary of a Harvard Murder. Now, The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.